ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, Sana Qadar here from All in the Mind. Check out our new series, Forensic. It's all about the psychological tools and tricks that come with investigating crime.
He was setting the bombs off in subways, in the New York Public Library, in movie theaters.
When you're testifying in court, rather than having purely your own memory, you take on all these little bits and pieces of information from different sources.
All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Book Show, where today you'll hear about past lives, fated futures, and fish. I'm Claire Nichols, so pleased to tell you that Veronica Roth will be here later. She's the author famous for her dystopian YA series Divergent, and she's just finished work on a new adult sci-fi fantasy, which I loved. She's going to tell you all about it and what it's like to grapple with a series as famous as Divergent. But first, it's Past Lives, Reincarnation and Fish with Amitav Ghosh. I'm taking you to India, specifically Calcutta, as it was then known, in the 1960s. In the house of a rich family, a three-year-old girl wakes up demanding to eat fish, shocking her strictly vegetarian parents. Now, is this just the whims of a fussy toddler? Or could this be proof of a prior life lived as a fisherwoman in a rural community? Amitav Ghosh is best known for his Ibis trilogy, and he brings us this story in his new book, Ghost Eye. Hi, Amitav.
Hi, Claire. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
I want to get straight into reincarnation, if we can, Amitav. Is this something you believe in?
You know, I'm not sort of keen on using the word reincarnation, because reincarnation is a kind of metaphysical term. You know, it implies that there's a soul that migrates from one body to another and so on, and that, you know, you can earn your future life by what you're doing in this life and that kind of thing. And maybe that's the case. I don't know. I'm agnostic about that. But what I do know is that there a surprisingly large number of children are born every year with memories of past lives, which they suddenly awaken to at about the age of two or three. And, you know, these memories are very powerful for a while. And then around about the age of five or six, the memories begin to fade as they grow into their bodies, as it were. And eventually the memories just fade away altogether. But there's just so much, that's been collected on this that really, I think it's pointless to talk about it as something that one believes in. I mean, it's just a reality.
Wow. I have not come across this research. So I'm guessing you've had a look at a lot of these studies.
Yes, there's an enormous number of studies. A lot of them are, you know, conducted by the University of Virginia. They have a department there, one part of which is dedicated to these studies. And literally, they've collected tens of thousands of cases, and not just in Asia. A lot of them are from Europe and especially the United States and Canada. So, you know, that's just one. I mean, there are a couple of other university departments that have been studying this phenomenon. So it's nothing new. It's all there.
Mm. And this book, Ghost Eye, it's suggesting there is more to life than science would have us believe, Amitav Ghosh. Do you see evidence of this in your day-to-day life?
I see it all the time. Absolutely. One sees confirmation of, that the world is much more mysterious and actually, I would say, much more wonderful than the usual sort of materialistic, numbers-based approach would have us think.
This happens even in writing for you, right? Like sometimes you'll write something and it's almost like you're predicting the future.
It has happened for me, happened to me several times. Yes, I've had those uncanny experiences. Many, you know, too many times to just for me to dismiss them as, as coincidence or whatever. And, you know, I could give you a long list. But yes, I've had that experience many times. And I think many writers have, you know. And actually, if you think about it, writing is in itself a kind of oddball activity, you know. It's not a normal thing. I mean, those of us who become writers are, in some sense, not your regular people or just your normal people. I mean, there's something that makes us get into this art or craft or whatever you call it. And Stephen King, I think, says it better than anyone else. I mean, you know, he's often said that the ideas for his books come to him from somewhere outside himself. You know, he doesn't actually know where they come from.
What about for you? Do you know where your ideas come from?
No, and I don't think a writer can really claim that they, I mean, unless they're sort of very systematic, and there are writers like that, you know, who plan everything out and who have a whole sort of storyboard that carries them along. I am not that kind of writer at all. And I do know that as one writes, strange things happen. It's really also so unpredictable. I mean, you think of the poet Rainer Maria Rilke. For more than a decade, he wrote nothing. But at the same time, he just prepared and prepared and prepared. And then suddenly, in a very short spurt, he wrote his great masterpiece, the Duino Elegies. And I think there are just so many examples of that kind of thing, you know, that one really can't dismiss it out of hand. With this book, Ghost Eye, really, I felt like it was writing itself.
Wow.
Usually it takes me years and years to write a novel. But with this one, it was just literally just writing itself.
Wow. What was the starting point? What was the beginning spark for this?
I suppose in the research on past life memories, one thing that really stands out a lot is that children who are born with these past life memories, many of their memories are very powerfully tied to food.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are children in Burma who have past life memories of being Japanese soldiers, and they won't eat Burmese food. They want raw fish, and they want, you know, very bland Japanese food. But it happens most of all in India. Because often in India, various communities have different dietary kinds of rules and regulations and so on, and, you know, customs and that kind of thing. And it often happens that a child is born into a family that's vegetarian, and they have memories of being non-vegetarian before. And weirdly enough, they become very insistent, you know, until the families actually give in and let them eat what they want. And the same thing happens the other way around, so that children are born into non-vegetarian families and they have very strong memories of being vegetarians before, and they simply cannot stomach non-vegetarian food.
I feel like parents listening might take comfort from this, Amitav Ghosh. Their fussy eaters might not just be difficult. They might be remembering the diet of a past life.
That's perfectly possible, but I very much doubt it. I think something very profound has changed, especially in Western diets, so that children, you know, have become increasingly fussy.
All right, well, maybe we won't go down that road, but let's talk about the child in this book. Their name is Varsha. She's 3 years old, very headstrong, very bright little girl, and she lives in this very strictly vegetarian household. Can you just give us a sense of how determined this kid is to eat some fish?
I mean, again, there are many documented cases just like this, where the child will simply refuse to eat whatever they're served. In fact, you know, after reading my book, a very eminent writer, and not Indian actually, from the Middle East, told me that they had a case like this in their family.
Wow.
You know, yeah. I mean, since this book came out, I've been on the receiving end of so many stories from so many unexpected people.
I'd love to talk some more about food. So in the novel, the family calls in this child psychologist. Her name is Shoma, and Shoma has an interest in past lives and is really keen to figure out what's going on with this little girl, Varsha. And she decides to set Varsha this kind of test to see how much this kid knows about fish, which she's never eaten. So Shoma prepares these different fishes cooked in different ways and feeds them to the little girl to see if she can identify these very kind of obscure fishes and obscure dishes. The food descriptions in this book are so mouth-watering, Amitav Ghosh. I want to know, like, these are specifically Bengali foods. Like, what are the significance of these dishes in your own life?
Oh, they're incredibly important. You know, food is the primary medium through which human beings understand their environment. It ceased to be the case in the modern West, where, you know, you walk into a supermarket and nobody knows where the food comes from. Mm. But certainly I grew up in a world where really this connection to our world and to our environment through food was very, very important. And I think everywhere, you know, there's a sense in which food creates a sense of identity, a sense of belonging. And this is certainly very much the case in Bengal, which is where I'm from. Now, Bengal is a riverine land, you know. I mean, it's incredibly watery. There are these incredibly powerful rivers flowing through all of Bengal. And because of this, there are literally hundreds of different species of freshwater fish. And people have a very powerful sense of connection, you know, with these fishes. I mean, if you go to a Bangladeshi store, you're in Australia, I imagine.
Yes.
You know, if you go to a Bangladeshi store, you'll see that there'll be a whole section of it completely dedicated, you know, to frozen fish from Bengal. Bengalis everywhere are deeply, deeply attached to it. I was just in Spain, you know, and I remember driving, you know, I was in a taxi going through Barcelona, and suddenly we passed a shop where it was written in Bengali, Bengali fish available here. It was really so striking to me. It's just a very important part of our culture.
The narrator of this book, Ghost Eye, is Dinu, or Dean. He's a retired man living in Brooklyn in 2020 during the COVID lockdowns. He's Shoma's nephew. He's a bookish guy. And as I was reading this, Amitav, I realised, oh, I know Dean. He was in the last book you wrote, Gun Island.
That's right.
Is this a sequel or what is this?
I wouldn't say it's a sequel. I certainly didn't have that in mind. But there's certainly a kind of intertextuality, if you like. I just grew very attached to Dean's voice and to the kind of person that Dean is. You know, I didn't start this book with Dean as such, but very soon it just as I said, it wrote itself. It took itself in that direction.
And Dean, being this bookish guy in Brooklyn, looking back to his childhood in Calcutta, should we see Dean as some sort of stand-in or cipher for you, Amitav Ghosh?
Well, obviously there are these overlapping elements of biography. Dean grows up in Calcutta, me too, and I'm in Brooklyn, and so is he. But you know, that part of it is just, as they say, to write what you know, you know. And I know these, I know Brooklyn, I know Calcutta, and I know some other places like the Sundarban, which Dean also knows. But apart from that, no, Dean's life is nothing like mine. I mean, he has his own life. Nor would I say that his temperament is anything like mine. So he's a completely different person.
How are your temperaments different?
Well, Dean is basically a chronicler. You know, he's just like a living chronicle. He's just recording what he sees. That's not me at all. I'm always out there, you know, finding things, reporting on things. I began my career as a journalist, so that's a very important part of my life and my practice.
You mentioned the Sundarban. This was a very important location in the last book, the last novel, Gun Island, as well. Can you remind listeners what this place is, the Sundarban, and what its meaning is, particularly to you, Amitav?
The Sundarban is the world's largest mangrove forest. It's the southern fringe of the Bengal Delta. So it is an enormous forest of mangrove. And mangrove forests are very different from any other kind of forest. And the Sundarban, I've been going there since I was a boy because one of my uncles lived there. So that was what made me want to write about the Sundarban. And in the year 2000, I started, really getting deeply into research on the Sundarban and so on. And it was that experience that really exposed me to what's happening in the world in terms of all the many environmental crises that we face, that is climate change, biodiversity loss, species extinctions, and so on. But the Sundarban is a very powerful environment. I did a program with Take Four Books of BBC, and they had just interviewed Rob McFarlane, whose work I like a lot, and he's written a wonderful book called Is a River Alive? And they were quoting Rob McFarlane to me because Rob, who's a good friend, actually says that he felt at various points that the river was writing the book with him. So, again, the Sundarban is like that. It's a very alive landscape where you can feel the vitality of the earth. And ever since I started really getting into the Sundarban the year 2000, I mean, it's just come back to me again and again. And in some way, I feel, as Rob said, that this landscape is writing with me.
Is there an urgency to writing about this place given the effects that climate change is having on the Sundarban?
Oh, yes, absolutely. All these concerns of mine grow out of a profound sense of urgency. Because really, we can all see that the world is heading towards absolute collapse. I mean, several species going extinct every day, the incredible biodiversity loss that we see all around us, and of course, all these disasters that are sort of unfolding all around us. So once you've seen all that, you can't unsee it. Because really, now we're no longer writing about the planetary crisis. We are writing from within the planetary crisis, So in one way or the other, it is going to manifest, certainly in everything I write.
I think this is increasing more and more in fiction, though. You famously wrote a non-fiction book, The Great Derangement, which looked at how do we talk about the climate crisis through fiction. I think since that time, there has been an absolute explosion in writing fiction about climate change. It struck me that Ian McEwan's recent climate change book, What We Can Know, he actually called it The Derangement. I wondered if he was speaking back to your own work there, Amitav.
Many people have pointed this out and they've said that he's obviously read my book or whatever. I don't know. I can't say. I haven't read his book yet. Certainly, since in the last 10 years, there's been a huge outpouring of writing about the planetary crisis. But it's not that people weren't writing about these issues before. Mm-hmm. They were. But the problem was that the broader literary ecosystem tended to marginalize those voices, tended not to foreground, as it were, that kind of writing, which was generally treated as, science fiction or writing fantasy or something like that. But that is what has really changed, I think, over the last few years. That it's no longer possible to completely marginalize that kind of writing. And then there's another book that really sort of runs parallel to my way of thinking. The writer is Ruth Ozeki. Her writing is just so interesting and important. She is a Zen Buddhist practitioner. And I think what she is trying to do is so much like I'm trying to do, which is somehow to restore voice and agency to the non-human world. I mean, I think of that as being the great literary challenge of our time.
And we appreciate what you're doing, Amitav Ghosh. The new book is called Ghost Eye. It's published by John Murray. It's wonderful to talk to you again.
Wonderful to talk to you, Claire. Thank you so much for having me.
On ABC Radio National, this is The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols, and Veronica Roth is here now. She's had an enviable career. She came up with her first novel, Divergent, when she was still at uni. And as you no doubt know, that dystopian novel became a series, which has now sold more than 35 million copies worldwide. Now, 15 years after Divergent was published, Veronica Roth has just released the first in an adult sci-fi fantasy series. It's called Seek the Traitor's Son, and it follows a young woman fated to save her people in a world divided amongst those that worship the so-called fever and those that don't. Veronica Roth joins me now from Chicago. Hi, Veronica.
Hi.
I love a map at the start of a book. And this one made me sit up straight away because one of the key locations in this book is Naam, or Melbourne,
yeah,
in a place that you call Austra, or short for Australia, I'm guessing. So before you tell us why Melbourne has made its way into this book, perhaps you can tell us about your relationship with this place.
Well, my husband and I went to Australia a few years ago, and it made a huge impact on us. We went to the Great Barrier Reef, first of all, because a friend, honestly, just because an Australian friend was like, go there before it disappears, which was good advice, mm-hmm, which is sad advice, but good. And then I did a tour, like a 3-week tour for Divergent, basically, in Australia. And I loved it. And I just thought, you know, I have to choose places. I try to choose places I've been when I'm writing books, because then it'll have a little more verisimilitude when I write it. And so I was like, what about, you know, what if it was in Melbourne? Because I really love that place. So,
and you know what? Readers from Naam or Melbourne will love the fact that even in a future ravaged by disaster, the coffee in Melbourne is still really good in this book.
Yes. That was my big Australian joke, because the coffee was insane. It's so good. And I know Australians are coffee people. Yes.
Yeah, it did make me chuckle that, you know, it's the one place in the world where you can still get a decent cup of coffee. But
correct,
you've also called it Naam in the book, which shows a really great, you know, cultural awareness, especially coming so far away from Chicago. How did you get across all of that?
Yeah, so it's part of the world building, actually. It's just that not all of the places, because I don't think naming is ever that consistent, but a lot of the places in this nation that does not worship the fever in the book have endonyms. So an endonym being the name that a people call themselves, as opposed to the name that is imposed by like the greater political order. Mm-hmm. So I tried to choose those selectively. And I know that when we were in Australia, land acknowledgements were such a huge part of like the events that I was doing there. And that's the first time I'd ever heard that done. So I thought it would be particularly good and true to my experience to call it by its other name.
Mm, yeah, its original name. And in order to explain the whole relevance of these new places and these new names,
yeah,
you better explain, if you can, Veronica, the world in which this story, Seek the Traitor's Son, is set.
Yeah, so it's a little bit like it's two nations, but one is much larger than the other. It is an empire, actually. So that's the Talasar. They, everyone is afflicted with this fever, basically. The fever kills everyone who gets it, and then it brings half of them back to life with special abilities that are usually related to the past. And then, you know, standing against them in quarantine is this other nation, Cedra, which is just kind of composed of several, like, geographically distinct entities. And Australia is one. Nusanta is the name for the other one. That's Indonesia. And then Losan, which is Los Angeles. And then Sedri Station, which is like a space station. And they can use technology, but the Talasar, because of the fever, cannot. So there's a real, like, half of this book is sci-fi and the other half is fantasy feeling about it.
Yeah, very like old school versus new school in a way.
Yes.
And need I ask where fevers and quarantine, where that inspiration came from?
Yes. As you have assumed correctly, I started writing right before COVID, but then a lot of this book I was writing during COVID and as I was, you know, emotionally and mentally processing that pandemic, which, you know, is ongoing.
I love that we, the nation, which includes Australia, the Cedra Nation, is very tech focused. And we do have people living in a space station. So there's this kind of space element to this novel as well, and a kind of intergalactic. Yes. I mean, you've set your goalposts so wide. Does it get overwhelming?
So yes, I think mostly it was overwhelming when we were first trying to figure out how to explain it to people, you know, because that's what marketing is just like, how do I explain this in a way that feels accessible to people? You know, because I don't think that the book is terribly inaccessible despite, you know, this kind of grand world building ambition, because I was very focused on keeping the story intimate between these two characters and their circle of friends and their families. And making sure that all the action, no matter what's happening, is really affecting them personally and that it stays close to them. And part of that is because I think that's the kind of writer that I am. And I realized that while writing this book. It's like, well, why would I write about these things I don't care about as much? Like, I care about these people and I care about the emotional complexity that exists between them. So I'm just going to try to focus on that. I'm going to arrange all of my action to like stay tight.
So if they're the things you care about, what are the things you don't care about?
Well, I had like really large and grand action scenes in earlier drafts and they got unwieldy. And also the bigger they got, the less realistic they were. Cause I don't know like how this like space battle would go. Like I'm not a military strategist and I could spend a lot of time learning about that, or I could try and find ways to make it smaller. So I don't know how specific you want to get me to get here, but there was like the scene that's in Narm actually was much bigger. And now it's more focused on like there's a kidnapping and they're trying to retrieve a person. And that just felt more manageable to me.
I think you've identified for me so many of the reasons why I really love this book, Veronica, because while it is this kind of epic scope, it is about personal relationships. So let's talk about the people. Our heroine is Elegy, great name. She is the second daughter of the sword. Do you want to explain?
Yes.
Do you want to explain what that means?
Yeah, she's like a princess, but she's not a princess, right? So the sword of Sedra is the person. It's the commander in chief of the military. So it's not supposed to be a position of royalty, but it has sort of acquired that status as this nation has fought to survive against their enemies. So she is the second daughter. She's the spare. So she's like,
she's
just
Prince
there
Harry.
In case. Yes, she is. She's the Prince Harry of this family. And so she's kind of allowed to be more free. And so she has become a soldier at the start and she works for search and rescue.
And she's a great character. Tell me what you like about this woman.
You know, I wrote this book over the course of 10 drafts, not 10 complete drafts, but 10 experimental drafts, some more fantasy, some more sci-fi. One was YA. That was a terrible idea. And the thing that always stayed true to her is that there are some things she simply will not do in order to get her way. And they specifically relate to Theron, the other main character of this book. She will not hurt him any more than he's already been hurt. And she's like the one person standing against that like action. So I like that about her, that she's principled, but she's not like sweet. she's not like super nice. So she, you can be a good person without being like a sweet person. And I think I like that about her. Yeah. She's tough. She's got grit.
A little bit of salty with the sweetness.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And at the start of the book, she receives a prophecy, which is going to change her life. What do we need to know about this prophecy, Veronica Roth?
Well, basically it says that it's possible that she's one of two people who might save her people It's hard to explain. she might save her people against their enemies. And along the way, like one of the signposts along the way is that she'll fall in love with a man who will bring her death. Mm. So that's a grim pronouncement.
Yes. And this man is Theron. I'm not surprised that every woman that comes into contact with Theron seems to fall in love with him, because he is a completely lovable character. And it's kind of hard to talk about him because a lot happens to him in the first few chapters of the book that I don't want to spoil. But who is this young man when the novel opens?
He is just a library custodian, but he has his mother made a deal with the Sedra government that when he came of age, he would have to swear himself in a knight oath to protect the sword. And then once Elegy hears the prophecy, he swears the oath to protect her instead. So he's her knight. Mm. And he's just like, he loves poetry. I don't know. He's a sweetheart with very little responsibility at the start.
Mm. This is being marketed as the first of two books and yes. Marketed as your adult novels. This is not Divergent. You said earlier that you did try writing this as a YA novel and it didn't work, which I find fascinating because a lot of authors yes. say they don't really know when they write a book if it's, say, YA or adult fiction. They just write the story. But it sounds like for you there was a very clear distinction in how you write a story for an audience.
Well, in this case, it was because of time. So the relationship is like each individual character and their relationship together is characterized by kind of grief. So both of them have endured something difficult and they have to navigate that difficulty together. And I needed the time to have weight. So when I tried to make them younger, they can still go through hardship, but it doesn't settle into their body in the same way that it does when you're older. And so the story felt a little bit weightless when it was for young people. It was still fun, but I only wrote like 30 pages of it because I just thought, these aren't the characters. This isn't the story. It's not designed for this market.
And I mean, of course, you wrote Divergent when you were so young yourself, Veronica. Is this just a natural progression? As you get older, your characters are going to get older and your audience is going to get older too?
Well, I don't know. I thought so. Yeah. And now I have a YA book coming out in October. So I guess I went back, right? But it's different now. I have a lot more distance over that perspective now. And I do think my adult books have a different like theme. So every writer is basically writing the same story over and over again, right? Like we can't avoid it. But in my case, I think I'm writing two different stories over and over again. One is the YA story and one is the adult story. My adult stories are always about guilt specifically, like dealing with the sudden, like the awareness that you've been a participant in something awful. And how do you navigate that emotionally and in the world? I don't know why.
So I'm going to ask, where does it come from, do you think, this? Because if you're always writing about it, it's got to come from somewhere within you, right?
Yeah, I think so. But I don't know that it's not like a therapy session exactly, but I think it's just when I'm very curious about that and the way that I think societally, like we don't create a whole lot of avenues for people to find redemption. Some people obviously don't ask for it and we could argue do not deserve it. But people who do, you know, I think we have this feeling that if someone is one way, then they'll always be that way. And I guess I am interested in pressing up against that idea. Like, well, you know, what does it take for me to forgive someone and what do they have to do and how much do they have to change in order for me to believe them? Which is hard. I mean, I don't have easy answers about it. Otherwise I probably wouldn't be writing about it.
I love hearing about the very clear distinction between your adult work and your YA work. And I did want to go back to Divergent for a moment because it was, as I said in the introduction, such a huge thing for you at such a young age. Can you tell me what it's like to have that level of success that early in your writing career?
Well, I had an undiagnosed anxiety disorder. So I think what I can tell you is that it was very stressful. There were, I mean, obviously amazing things that happened because of that series. It really set up my career and I'm very grateful for it. But there were hard things too. It was a lot of feedback to take in. It's a lot for anyone, but especially for someone who's so inexperienced in the world. I think I could see that now, that it was hard on me and I took a lot of it in. And it's only recently that I've been able to kind of stop sucking in that negativity like a sponge because of years of therapy. So it had its hard parts. I mean, obviously the good parts were pretty good though.
it reminds me, I've talked a couple of times to Samantha Shannon who had a similar journey to you, huge success, very yes. young. It caused a lot of stress and anxiety for her. And I think that's something that people don't think about when they hear these, you know, glittering stories of young success about the toll that it can take on a young writer. The other problem that Samantha had is looking back at her early works that she doesn't like them so much now. And she's actually gone off on this huge project of rewriting those early books.
Yes.
How do you feel when you look back at the Divergent books?
Well, I have complicated feelings. For a long time, if someone said something negative about them, I just kind of believed them. And I think that is a self-protective, like, instinct. So you say, like, well, people are mocking me, right? Because people online were mocking me. Mm-hmm. And if I join in, then we're all just laughing together, you know? And I think that's like a, and it worked for a long time. It really helped me to cope with the negativity. And then a few years ago, I thought, I don't want to do that anymore. Like, it feels bad, actually. And it's not good for me. And Divergent keeps selling, which is a great gift. But it also means I can't just ignore it. Like, it's not going to go away. And so I started to work on this other project, which I've recently announced, called The Sixth Faction, which mm-hmm. is an alternate universe telling of Divergent, where Triss chooses a different choice, if that makes sense to anyone who's listening.
I'm sure it makes sense to a lot of people.
Yeah, so she takes a different path. But I thought of, it's funny that you should talk about Samantha, because I thought about her and her 10-year anniversary edition, like reapproaching her old work while I was doing it, and thinking about how brave that is for her and how hard it can be. For me, I found a way into it that felt more like creating something new. Than having to contend with all of the, you know, all the cringe of anything that you write when you're 23, like you're going to go back and go, oh God, about certain things. So for me, this was like a way to make it new, and it was really wonderful.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you've been able to, you know, form a new relationship with these works that are so important to so many readers as well. Before I let you go, I just wanted to come back to Seek the Traitor's Son for a moment, just to talk about a couple of inventions of yours, tech inventions of yours.
Oh, yeah.
One thing I really loved in the Cedra world is if someone wants to send you a message, you might get a little tingling in your fingers. Can you explain how that works?
Yes. So everyone in Cedra, almost everyone, gets the elixir, which is basically an injected internet is the best way to explain it. So, you know, instead of having to carry a device, you basically carry the internet in your blood. And so if you get infected with fever, it like burns the elixir from your body. That's why the Talisar can't use the Cedra technology. So when you get a message, though, you can feel it like an itch in your fingertips. And then you pick up a device and you write a letter. I thought it was romantic.
Yeah, and you call it a quill, which again is very romantic, but you don't know what you're writing. Because the thing you're writing down is the message from someone else. It's kind of creepy.
Yes, it's creepy, and it's in their handwriting.
And of course, if you and I were in this world, we wouldn't have to be talking over a video chat like we are right now, because I could enter a veil to talk to you,
yes.
Veronica Roth. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so all that technology that they use, et cetera, is inherited from an unknown ancestor. So that accounts for some of, you know, it's not all like cohesive. It's not like all of it cooperates. And it's also all for public use. So they don't really believe in like personal devices. The messages are an exception, but you have to go to like a public veil, which is like almost like a public telephone, except this like net clings to your body and projects you to someone else who is then projected to you. So you're having a face-to-face conversation, but you have to walk through this like archway first.
I love that. How fun is it to come up with stuff like this?
It's really fun. The danger is that like you have to create some kind, you have to make it feel like it goes together. You can't just like make stuff up. So I think you can't let all of your ideas play in sci-fi fantasy, but I let a lot of them loose in this book.
And you can save the leftovers for another time, I guess.
That's right. Nothing is ever wasted in writing.
So now you've got a sequel to write to Seek the Traitor's Son. You're also working...
Oh, it's done.
It's done. That's quick, because you're also working on this new Divergent series as well.
They are actually both done as well. So let me tell you about the crazy thing I did.
Please.
Which is that I wrote the Seek the Traitor's Son series back to back. So all of it at the same time, as if it was one book, mm-hmm. although I knew that it was two. And then I did the same thing for The Sixth Faction and its sequel. And this has been happening over the course of 4 or 5 years. While I was just like, the only things I published in those years were novellas, because mm-hmm. on the side, I was working on these longer works. So I'm done now.
So are you taking a break?
Yes. No, I mean, I'm doing this promotional cycle for these books because I care about them and I want to give them their best start. But then after that's done, then yeah, I'll take a break. Maybe I'll go back to Australia, which I've been trying to do for the last 10 years. But of course, COVID kind of interrupted it for a while. So.
All right, Veronica, we'll come and have a coffee here in Australia. It has been so lovely.
And a Tim Tam.
And a Tim Tam. It's been so good to talk to you. Your new novel is Seek the Traitor's Son. It's published by Pan Macmillan. It's been really wonderful to meet you today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And that's Veronica Roth. And on ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Book Show with me, Claire Nichols. The Book Show is produced by Sarah Lestrange. Thank you, Sarah. We make this show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. Make sure you're following the show on ABC Listen. Next time, Siri Hustvedt will join me to remember the life and grieve the loss of her writer husband, Paul Auster. Until then, take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.